Hey, you're listening to World Cafe. I'm Talia Schlanger. Today, a fascinating collaboration between Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Turrisi. Rhiannon is the beloved singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist co-founder of Carolina Chocolate Drops. She's also written a ballet, appeared on the TV show Nashville, received the MacArthur Foundation's prestigious fellowship, and somehow also had time to form the new folk roots supergroup Our Native Daughters. Francesco is a really exciting musician in his own right. He is conservatory-trained jazz musician, pianist, multi-instrumentalist. He's an expert on the often unacknowledged influence of Arabic music on what we think of as European art, while you know Rhiannon's work has focused a lot on the influence of African traditions on what we think of as American music. In other words, both Rhiannon and Francesco are devoted students of music history whose mission is to use the past to illuminate the present and to give credit where credit's due for the way instruments and ideas have moved over time between people. They used all that knowledge to make gorgeous music together on a new album called There Is No Other, and here they are performing the song 10,000 Voices. Live for World Cafe, Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Turrisi with 10,000 Voices. That is from their new collaboration together called There Is No Other. Welcome to World Cafe.
Thank you.
Hello.
Yeah, and just because people can't see you in that performance, can you, Francesco, tell me what instrument you were playing?
I was playing a cello banjo. It's an original 1920s Gibson cello banjo that belongs to Rhiannon, kindly lent to me. And it's strung with kind of gut strings and play with an Arabic oud pick, so it's pretty unique sound. We also had Jason Cipher on bass.
So World Cafe listeners are a bit more familiar with your work, Rhiannon, and in terms of illuminating the way that African American history influences current American music. And you have a lot in common with Francesco in that regard, I think, in terms of your approach to history and music. And since this is the first time that our audience is meeting Francesco, maybe, Francesco, you can tell us a little bit about the music meets history angle that you yourself as an artist are coming from.
Well, I have a bit of an odd trajectory, I guess, in a way, quite similar to Rhiannon. I am conservatory trained, but I studied jazz piano. That's what I did in BA and a master's. But while doing that, I got interested in early music. And at the same time, kind of later in life, you know, at the time of college, I also got really interested in different types of music, from traditional and classical music from the Mediterranean area. I'm very nerdy and quite obsessed with research in the same way that Rhiannon is. So a lot of the stuff that I've been focused on tries to look at the connections between, especially with the Islamic influence in Europe, you know. So my family is from Sicily and Arabs were there for nearly 400 years. So there is a very obvious kind of influence there, but not so many people are aware of, you know. The other thing is the fact that, you know, the Arabic Empire at the time, we're talking about the late Middle Ages, had a really profound and immense influence on everything in Europe, you know. Some people say there wouldn't have been a Renaissance without everything that the Arabs brought, you know. So you can argue almost that every Western instrument comes from an Arabic instrument, you know. Mm. So I've been trying to a little bit uncover that kind of side of musical history that people sometimes don't really like to talk about, because, you know, from the Renaissance on, there's been a little bit of denial of what this influence is. And certainly something that is quite popular now as well, with all its various anti-Arab, you know, othering, since we're talking about that.
Sure. It sounds like maybe you would have found something in common together in terms of the unacknowledged influence of Arabic music on European art, and then for Rhiannon, the often unacknowledged influence of African traditions on what we think of as American music. Like, did you find more, I guess, common threads between those very different places than you might have thought before you started working together?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, that's exactly what the threads that kind of brought us together, that kind of mission aspect of the work, you know, because what that connection across the Atlantic that we've made now, brings into sharp relief the fact that these things are not isolated to any place or people. This idea of othering, this idea of rewriting history, this idea of creating a false cultural narrative, you know, that has happened in the United States, that's happened in Europe. You know, this used to be a mosque. We're going to pretend like it's always been this way and call it a church and, you know, make a few changes. Then voila, they were never here. You know, there's a larger even connection that goes back, you know, thousands of years. And it's just, it really kind of makes you realize, oh God, you know, we're not really alone in this insanity.
Yeah. The next song that we're going to hear you perform brings that into focus in a really interesting way. Francesco, do you mind saying the title for me before I say it? It's Pizzica?
Pizzica di San Vito.
Okay. So this is a song that's in Italian, and the instrumentation feels like it has Arabic influence in it. Tell me a little bit about this song, first of all, and what it's about.
It's a traditional pizzica. Pizzica is a type of tarantella dance from Puglia. Traditionally, this music was used, one of the uses of this music was for trance dance, curing the bite of the spider. That's what people believed, you know. It was probably fitting into a phenomenon which was quite common in a lot of areas of the Mediterranean, of basically using trance dancing to heal certain forms of I don't know, let's call it depression. I don't know if it's the right word, but it was observed for the last time in the 1960s, completely, you know. So anyway, the song, it's in Apulian dialect, actually. It's a particular type of dialect from Salento, which is the region where this music is from. And I'm playing the tamburello, which is a little tambourine, which is a very important instrument for this healing trance dancing. And Rhiannon is playing the minstrel banjo, actually, She's that you want to talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I play. And the thing is, the thing about, like, say, the minstrel banjo, which is fretless and is a replica of a banjo from the 1850s, when it still retained a lot of its African character, you know, a lot more closely related to the gourd, you know, sort of homemade instruments that would have been made back when it was known as solely a black instrument, you know, a plantation instrument. And so those instruments, you know, are derived from, they became the banjo in America, but they come from a set of ancestors of, you know, lute type instruments in West Africa that then themselves, you know, go back to instruments that would have also spawned the oud and, you know, these other instruments. So there is actually quite a long connection, which is why, you know, I can play certain lines on the minstrel banjo and it still, you kind of feel that kind of oud character because there it is in that instrument as well, that kind of common ancestor.
Okay, that's a great setup. Let's hear you perform the song. This is Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Torisi with Pizzica di San Vito. Incredible. So that's Pizzica di San Vito performed by Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Torisi. They're here with me on World Cafe, and that version that they're performing of that song appears on their new album together called There Is No Other. So we just heard you, Rhiannon, play on the minstrel banjo, which is your instrument, on one of your instruments, but the one that we hear you play the most on that song. And then Francesco also mentioned playing the cello banjo earlier. Can you explain a little bit about the difference between them, because I think therein sort of lies some of the forgotten history of the banjo as an instrument that is from West Africa.
Absolutely. So I just give you a real quick kind of overview. So you have West African lutes, you know, that come with people or the idea of them come. And Haiti is the earliest banjo that we have, banza. It's a banza, where it becomes like an instrument of its own. And then it travels up to North America and becomes a fixture of enslaved people and of African-American people. And then in the 1840s, it's taken up by white people, turned into the minstrel banjo. So from a gourd to a wooden hoop with the fretless, you know, fingerboard. And then between there, it starts to get it acquires frets. It starts to, you know, get metal. So it starts getting louder. It starts becoming more European on the one hand, but then it also starts being used in jazz on the other. So around in the 20s and 30s, you had this craze for the banjo orchestra, which was seemed to be primarily a white thing. You'd have them at like the Yale Banjo Orchestra, the Princeton Banjo Orchestra, the Australian Ladies Banjo Orchestra. I'm not kidding. There were like a million of these things, and they would play classical music all on banjos. So you had the development of the different different kinds of banjos. You had piccolo banjo, which I have one, soprano banjo or banjarine. You had cello banjo, which is what Francesco plays on 10,000 Voices. You had a big bass banjo, baritone banjos. And then, you know, people are playing classical music all on banjos, you know. So then after that, you know, it develops also, is developing in Appalachia, you know, as sort of homemade instruments there as well. And then you have the advent of old-time music. You have the advent, well, old-time music's been around for a long time, but you have the advent of bluegrass, you know, where the rolling scrug style becomes very popular. And then that's kind of where people usually begin with a banjo.
Right.
Is there. But there's this entire history before, you know, and not to mention the Celtic, you know, the Irish banjo, which is the four-string banjo, or the tenor banjo from New Orleans, you know. So it's actually a huge history that is very hidden. And the fact that people start with bluegrass when it comes to the banjo is a little frustrating, but I understand that they're only knowing what they know because that's what's been told. You know, that's the story that's been told.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you about in the context of this album, I guess, is I read somewhere that you had used the Briggs banjo instructor book from like the mid-1800s as a teaching reference before. And so we've got Thomas Briggs, who's a white man who reportedly visited southern plantations and took songs that he heard in slave quarters and he performed in minstrel shows, and it's called the minstrel banjo. And that is such a painful part of African American history and such a it's just such an awful thing. And I'm wondering what it's like, because there are lots of people who would just want to sort of let that die and maybe ignore that. What makes you want to dig in and sort of shine a spotlight and twist these tools?
Well, I have to correct you on one thing. It's a painful part of American history. This is not African American history. It's American history. It's actually world history.
Thanks for that. Yep.
You know what I mean? And it's really important. I've become obsessed with minstrelsy because it is incomprehensible to me that it is one of the most influential movements musically on what then became known as American music, and has had a huge influence also abroad, and is one of the things that is the least talked about when it comes to American history, American cultural history. I mean, you know, from the 1840s, 1830s and 40s until the turn of the century, minstrelsy is one of the most popular forms, if not the most popular form for a large chunk of that, of a form of entertainment in America, right? This is a very universal. It is, you know, a lot of working class are going into this. It becomes a very, you know, it was an entryway into the entertainment industry, was minstrelsy. It was all over the place. It was in the North. It was in the South. It was in the West. And then it was spread to England and the UK and Ireland and Australia. You know, there's a picture of the Prime Minister of Australia, like at the turn of the century, like in a blackface troupe. You know, Mickey Mouse doesn't wear white gloves just because. Right. I mean, minstrelsy is like shot through every aspect of American culture and still with us. And so there is that whole thing. And then there's the music, you know, that comes from especially the early minstrelsy, which was a lot more connected to what was being played on the plantation and is that early black and white cultural exchange, you know, African and European, you know, mix that becomes a hallmark of American musical culture. You really hear it, and you hear it so deeply in that early music. And so my kind of obsession is becoming with, you know, let's talk about the painful aspects of minstrelsy, absolutely, because we have to, because not only because we just have to face up what was considered light entertainment, you know, and when you look at it through that lens, I mean, it's very, very painful, but we have to because of what's going on today. You know what I mean? Like this stuff just didn't happen for 5 years and disappear. I mean, it was an enduring thing. And why is that? Mm-hmm. You know, so we need to look at that. But then from a musicological point of view, I want to recast, like, for example, the Briggs book. There's no words. you know, to those tunes. And there's a lot to be learned from them. There's Africa, there's Ireland, there's, you know, they're really, really fresh modern tunes because they're the beginning of American music. Like, to me, that's one of the main beginnings, right, is this music. And we actually have, you know, we have it in notation, you know, and that's a start. It's a beginning. Like, you know, obviously I would love to hear recordings of what my ancestors were playing, you know, years ago, but we don't have those. This is what we have. You know, how can you use that as a jumping off point? And how can we recast minstrel music or that kind of music as early American music, you know, like the Dutch did for early European music? Like, it becomes then a force to be reckoned with. It becomes then something that we can learn from and not something that we're shoving under the carpet. So in sort of sneaking it in, you know, like Briggs Faro, you know, on the record is a minstrel tune from, you know, 1855, put together with a Brazilian tune by Hermeto Pascoal. And it's just like whenever I slip them into the show, we just play them as an instrumental and people are like, oh, my God, those tunes are so cool. And I'm like, yes, they are. You know,
yeah.
For me, it's like this is the earliest connection I have to the music that my ancestors played is this music. I'm just very passionate about it.
It's beautiful. I thank you so much. I just thank you so much for doing what you do. And I thank you for the really important correction that I don't want people to have missed, that I misspoke, that this is American history and this is world history. And it's everybody's to own. And the problem sort of begins when we don't see it as our own history.
Yeah, I mean, hey, but like, you know, I didn't know that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like I live in this stuff. You know, so I'm aware of it, but like I'm also aware of how invisible it is. So, you know, this is why we have the conversation.
Exactly. So let's play Briggs Faro from the record now, from There Is No Other. Briggs Faro, that is from There Is No Other, Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Turisi, who are here with me on World Cafe. Rhiannon, you're the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant, which I hope you don't mind me shining a lantern on, because I'm quite fascinated by this fellowship. Because to the best of my understanding, this is a foundation that believes that people who are making the world a better place through what they do deserve to have funding to be able to do that with no strings attached. And I can't think of a more worthy kind of person than you to have an honor like that. But I've talked to a couple of people who have been Genius Grant recipients, and everyone has a wacky story about how they found out that they were. So how did you find out?
My story is kind of boring, I have to say. And I will say this, the MacArthur Fellowship, they don't really like the term genius.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's I just say that, you know, because everybody calls it that. But I'm with them on it. But, like, I understand it's kind of a nice shorthand for people. Mm. But I just, I you know, I'm one of those. I'm the life of the party. The pedantic, actually. Let me shove up my, you know, non-existent glasses.
It's important. And it's, well, kind of weird for somebody to be like, you, like, it's a weird word to have to wear.
Yeah.
I can understand.
I mean, I just come from, like, having to talk about minstrelsy and slavery. And it's like, if I wasn't really accurate and exact in my wording, mm-hmm. it was a disaster. So it's just been 10 years of doing that. So it applies to everything. So I'm so sorry. How I found out was, I was actually kind of in a bit of a dark place. I was just really exhausted. As opposed to now, I'm just full of beans now. I'm not exhausted at all. No, I was really exhausted. And... and just kind of down, just kind of going, I'm really making nonprofit music on a consumer profit model, you know, which is really kind of what I was doing. I was trying to, you know, put this mission forward and, you know, do slave narrative songs, you know, on a model that really needs, you know, radio hits.
Right.
And trying to field, you know, and pay all of my people and, you know, do these bus tours. And I was just really, really getting a bit wrecked and just kind of going, you know, is there any point to this? Like, is anybody listening to what I'm trying to do, you know? And then I get this phone call. I was sitting at a cafe and somebody was like, you know, are you alone? And I was like, why do you want to know? but anyway, it was the call and, you know, it was a little overwhelming, but I mean, it really, I mean, the money of course is amazing. And the fact that, you know, you're only answerable to yourself with what you do to it, which is incredible. But really the thing that actually got me more, was the description that they give. They give you a description of the, you know, the people who, your peers who have like voted you in for this honor. And like, they write up a synopsis of why they think that you deserve it. And it just was like, me is basically what I've been trying to do for however many years, and to hear it being heard and sort of restated in a way that made me understand that it was heard. It was a powerful moment for me. You know, so that was really intense. The hardest thing was not being able to freaking tell anybody for like a month. Like that was torture. That was really, really torturous. But you know, sweet torture. I don't mind. I'm not complaining. But yeah, it was a pretty special moment. That's for sure.
So we are going to hear you perform one more song together from There Is No Other, this collaboration between Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Tirisi. And before we hear this song, can you tell me a little bit about Little Margaret and why you included this in this collection?
Well, it was actually one of the first connections that Francesco and I had. You know, Little Margaret's just been with me for a long time. I've done it in different ways. I've recorded it in different ways. It goes deep in my psyche, this song. And I just started singing it and he was playing and it was just kind of magic, you know. And I sent this little demo, this iPhone demo, off to Joe Henry, who produced the record. And I said, hey, Joe, I think this is the thing that I want to do next, you know, is this idea. And he kind of flipped over it and was like, yes, you know. And his reaction to the things that Francesco and I had been exploring really gave me the courage really to sort of pursue it in a very serious way. So that's, you know, it was the obvious choice to produce the record, of course. But yeah, so it's kind of got a special place, you know, for that reason.
Yeah. What are each of you playing on the song?
I'm playing a large frame drum called Daf, which is an instrument that comes from Iran originally. And it's got all these little kind of rings inside the frame that kind of hit the skin. And it's used in traditional music, but is also used by Sufis to sort of achieve trance through dancing and chanting, you know. So it's got this connection with trance, which we mentioned before as well, with Italian music. And yeah, it's a very interesting sound. You know, we fought, and that's what we did.
Great. Here we go.
Little Margaret sitting in her high hall chair, combing back her long yellow hair. Saw sweet William and his new maid Brad riding up the road so near. She threw down her ivory comb, threw back her long yellow hair. She said, I'll go down and I'll bid him farewell, and I'll never more go there. It was late in the night, they were fast asleep. Little Margaret appeared all dressed in white, standing at their bed feet, saying, how do you like your snow white pillow? How do you like your sheep? Saying, how do you like that pretty fair maid who lays in your arms asleep? Very well do I like like my snow white pillow? Well, do I like my sheep? Much better do I like that pretty fair maid who stands at my bed feet. He called a servant man to go saddle the dappled roan, and he rode for her father's house that night, knocked on the door alone, saying, is little Margaret in her room, or is she in the hall? Little Margaret's in her coal black coffin, with her face turned toward the wall. Unfold, unfold those snow white robes, be they ever so fine, for I want to kiss those cold, cold lips, for I know they'll never kiss mine. 3 times he kissed her cold, cold hand, twice he kissed her cheek, once he kissed her cold, cold lips, and he fell in her arms.
That's Little Margaret. That really is incredible. Performed by Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Torisi here at World Cafe. Their new collaboration together is called There Is No Other. It has been really fascinating and really stimulating to talk to you both. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. You are listening to World Cafe. There Is No Other is the name of the new collaboration between Rhiannon Giddens and Francesco Torisi. I want to thank both of them again for being here. They are so smart, so generous, so thoughtful, and so patient, which is, I think, one of the greatest qualities to have if you really dig deep on something and learn about stuff that you want to share with other people. I appreciate their approach so much. Go check out the whole album if you can. Thanks to our World Cafe senior producer, Kimberly Junod, for all of her work on that session. I'm Talia Schlinger, and I will catch you next time on World Cafe from NPR.